Today we've managed to come this great distance from Bodh Gaya to Rajagaha, just like the Buddha did on many occasions. But many of you will know the story of the Buddha, that after his enlightenment at Bodh Gaya, he travelled to another place, which we're going to at the end of our trip to India, to the place called Sarnath outside of Benares. And there he spent the first rains teaching his first five disciples. And after that, he decided to travel to Rajagaha, because he had visited this place before his enlightenment. He came here and was walking on arms round when the king, King Bimbisara, still a young king, saw him on arms round, got faith in the monk's bearing and restraint, and actually asked him who he was. And when he said that he was actually of royal parentage, and that he was seeking for enlightenment, the king actually said it's inappropriate that someone from such a royal lineage would actually seek for enlightenment. It's better if he came and actually joined with King Bimbisara and helped him govern. But such, even though he was invited to such prestige, he said he'd rather just carry on his search. They came to an agreement, because King Bimbisara made the Lord Buddha agree that if the Buddha became enlightened, he would actually come and see King Bimbisara. Yeah. Okay. Very good. Okay. So especially some few people talking outside. Is that better? Okay. So this is saying a little bit about the story of the Buddha. But first of all, the Buddha, as a young man, he left his home and he actually came to Rajagaha as the Bodhisattva, just not yet enlightened. And as he came to Rajagaha, the king saw him on arms round. The king got faith in just the appearance of the person who's about to become the Buddha. And as a result of that, he actually offered the Buddha a share of the kingdom. But the Buddha refused, because he would rather have the enlightenment which he was seeking. They came to this agreement, and when monks make agreement, they actually keep their promises. That's why that any one of you invites me to go here and go there, I'm very unlikely to agree unless I really am going to go, because if you invite me to go somewhere, as a monk you must always keep those agreements. And I get into big trouble sometimes when I say okay, and then I've got to keep that promise. But this is a tradition of monks: when we say something, we have to keep that promise. And so the Buddha actually promised to come back and see King Bimbisara after he became enlightened. So after the enlightenment, which happened at Bodh Gaya, where we were at yesterday, the Buddha travelled to Benares, to Sarnath, to teach the first five disciples, spent the whole rain retreat there, and after the rain retreat was completed, the Buddha had to fulfil his promise by coming back here to Rajagaha. So the Buddha travelled back here. But at this time, when he travelled back here, he didn't travel alone. He travelled with many of the disciples which he had converted, especially at Gaya and other places. And when they came back to Rajagaha, coming back with a lot of disciples, according to the story, no one knew actually who was the teacher and who was the student, because by this time the Buddha was still very young. He was only 36 years of age at that time. But all these other very, very famous teachers, like the three Kasapa brothers, who came here to Rajagaha. And it was actually Uruvela Kasapa, one of the leaders of these disciples of the Buddha, who actually bared his shoulder, like I'm baring my shoulder now, bowed down to this young man and said, "He is the Buddha, he is my teacher." And that really impressed the people of Rajagaha. Such a young person could have disciples much older than him, people who were in their own right famous teachers, but now recognize this young man as a Buddha. And so that was the beginning of the Buddha's teaching career here in the town of Rajagaha. And only a short while later, after the Buddha was staying here, that King Bimbisara, who remembered the Buddha from the time he visited before as a Bodhisattva, before his enlightenment, wanted to offer the Buddha a place to stay. Because understanding, if he gave the Buddha a place to stay, then the Buddha would stay and would be able to teach Bimbisara, King Bimbisara, the Dhamma. And so they, as at that time, the king offered to the Lord Buddha the bamboo grove, the Weruwana, which we are going to see tomorrow. I mention this point because there are some commentators who think that originally in Buddhism, the monks and the nuns would just wander from place to place and they wouldn't settle down in monasteries, thinking that the monasteries were something which happened in the later period, maybe even after the Buddha passed away, but that's certainly untrue. It's very clear to understand that because of the Buddha's promise that he came back here in the second year after his enlightenment, and that King Bimbisara offered that bamboo grove at that time, that it's quite clear that the monasteries were there from the very beginning of the time of the Buddha. And those monasteries which the Buddha agreed to were not just the simple. There were many halls, there were huts for the monks, there were also things like saunas for their well-being and other toilets. So those monasteries were very well established from the very early times. And so as a result that the monastery at the bamboo grove would be where the Buddha stayed most of the time. But he would also go up into places like the Vulture's Peak, into Satapani Cave, into the Indasala Cave, where the Sakha, the King of the Gods, visited the Buddha. There's many caves around this area where the Buddha would stay, but the bamboo grove would be almost like the central monastery, where people would come when they first visited here. And so because of that, there are many suttas which were told by the Buddha from the bamboo grove, or from the Vulture's Peak, and from the places around this area. And so just this afternoon I brought the Majjhima Nikaya with me, which is the reason why I'm wearing my glasses, so actually to read one or two extracts from these suttas. I counted 20 suttas from the Majjhima Nikaya, just from that alone, which was taught here at Rajagaha. And so this was one of the places where the Buddha taught the most, starting to spread the Dhamma far and wide. And people would visit the Buddha from far and wide. And so the first sutta which I'm going to teach today, or to read out today, is the one of the Vajragotha suttas. And Vajragotha was a wanderer who first met the Buddha at Vaisali, a place we're going to the day after tomorrow. And then went up to Sarvati to see the Buddha, and then finally followed him down here to Rajagaha, where he started to talk to the Buddha, and this was the place where he finally became enlightened. So I'm going to give an extract now from the Maha Vajragotha Sutta, the Greater Discourse to Vajragotha. Thus have I heard on one occasion the Blessed One was living at Rajagaha in the bamboo grove in the squirrel sanctuary, which is part of the bamboo grove. Then the wanderer, these are people who would wander from place to place, not be really attached to any particular teacher, wandering in search of enlightenment. The wanderer, Vajragotha, went to the Blessed One and exchanged greetings with him. When his courteous and amiable talk was finished, he sat down at one side and said to the Blessed One, I have had conversations with Master Gotama. Remember, he calls him Master Gotama, not the Buddha or Tathagata yet, because he hadn't got full faith yet. I have had many conversations with Master Gotama for a long time. It would be good if Master Gotama would teach me in brief the wholesome and the unwholesome. Wholesome is the word called kusala, and the unkusala, the akusala. I can teach you the akusala and the kusala in brief, Vajra, and I can teach you the wholesome and unwholesome at length. Even in that time, people wanted the short way. Still, I will teach you the wholesome and unwholesome in brief. Listen and attend closely to what I shall say. Yes, sir, he replied. The Blessed One said this, Vajra, greed is unwholesome, non-greed is wholesome. Hate is unwholesome, non-hate is wholesome. Delusion is unwholesome, non-delusion is wholesome. In this way, three things are unwholesome and other three things are wholesome. Kusala and akusala. So these are the three defilements of greed, hate and delusion, which the Buddha said are unwholesome. And he went on in further detail that killing living beings is akusala. Abstention from killing living beings is kusala. Taking what is not given is akusala. Abstention from taking what is not given is kusala. Misconduct in sensual pleasures is akusala. Abstention from misconduct in sensual pleasures is kusala. False speech or lying is akusala. Abstention from false speech is kusala. Malicious speech is akusala. Abstention from malicious speech is akusala. Harsh speech is akusala. Abstention from harsh speech is kusala. A vain talk or unnecessary gossip is akusala. Abstention from unnecessary talk is kusala. Greed is, or covetousness is akusala. Non-covetousness is kusala. Ill will is akusala. Non-ill will is kusala. Wrong view is akusala. Right view is kusala. These are what's called the 10 kusala pada and akusala pada. The 10 roots of the wholesome, the 10 roots of the unwholesome. In brief, they are the 5 precepts. Added to those 5 precepts, sorry, the 4 precepts, added to those 4 precepts are the other 3 types of wrong speech. Malicious speech, harsh speech, and stupid speech. Stupid speech means speech which has no purpose, just speech for its own sake. And also the covetousness, ill will, and wrong view. When a monk has abandoned craving, cut it off at the root, made it like a palm stump, done away with it, so it is no longer subject to future arising, no more craving, then that bhikkhu is an arahat with these outflowings destroyed. One who has lived a holy life, done what had to be done, laid down the burden, reached the true goal, destroyed the fetters of being, and is completely liberated through final knowledge. So I've been taught just a very brief of the wholesome and the unwholesome. The Buddha actually adds this extra piece here because knowing that Vajragota would be inspired by the even word, the Arahat, the enlightened one. Apart from Master Gotama, said Vajragota, is there any one monk, Master Gotama's disciple, who by realizing for themselves with direct knowledge here and now, enters upon and abides in the deliverance of mind and deliverance by wisdom, that they are without the outflowings, with the destruction of these outflowings? In other words, is anyone else enlightened other than the Master Gotama? And I'm reading this out because somebody asked me this question today of Satapanike. There are not only 100, Vacha, or 2, or 3, or 4, or 500, but far more than 500 bhikkhus, my disciples, who by realizing for themselves with direct knowledge, here and now, enter upon and abide in the deliverance of mind and deliverance by wisdom, that are without the outflowings, with the destruction of the outflowings. Apart from Master Gotama and the bhikkhus, is there even one bhikkhuni who is fully enlightened? There are not only 100 or 500, but far more than 500 bhikkhunis, my disciples, who are enlightened. Apart from Master Gotama and the bhikkhus and the bhikkhunis, is there any one man, male lay follower, Master Gotama's disciples, who, clothed in white, leading a life of celibacy, who, with the destruction of the 5 lower fetters, will reappear spontaneously in the pure abodes and there attain final nirvana without ever returning from that world? Anagamis, non-returners. Interesting here that such were understood even by Vajragota as to have to be celibate, leading white, living in white clothes, keeping those precepts. There are not just 100, or there are not even 500, but far more than 500 of my male lay disciples who are anagamis. Apart from Master Gotama, the monks and the bhikkhunis, and the men lay followers clothed in white, leading lives of celibacy, is there any one man lay follower, Master Gotama's disciples, clothed in white, enjoying sensual pleasures, who carries out his instructions, responds to his advice, who has gone beyond doubt, become free from perplexity, gained intrepidity, and become independent of others in the teacher's disciple dispensation? In other words, any stream winners. There are not only 100, 500, but far more than 500 men lay followers who are stream winners. Apart from Master Gotama, the monks and the bhikkhunis, and the men lay followers clothed in white, For as those leading the lives of celibacy, the anagamis, the non-returners, and those enjoying sensual pleasures, the stream winners, is there any one woman lay follower who, living a life of celibacy, is a non-returner? There are more than 500 women lay followers, my disciples, clothed in white, leading lives of celibacy, who are non-returners. Apart from us, the Gotama, the monks, the bhikkhunis, the men lay followers, both those clothed in white and those leading lives of celibacy, and those enjoying sensual pleasures, and the women lay followers clothed in white, leading lives of celibacy. Are there any other women who are stream winners? There are more than 500 women lay followers, my disciples, clothed in white, enjoying sensual pleasures, who are stream winners. And Vajra Gotama replies, Master Gotama, if only Master Gotama were accomplished in the Dharma, only Master Gotama was an arahat, but no other monks were accomplished, then the holy life would be deficient in that respect. But because Master Gotama and the monks are accomplished in this Dharma, the holy life is thus complete in that respect. And he goes on to say, if it was just that and no more, then the holy life would be deficient. But he said, because there are so many other monks and nuns who are arahats, there are so many lay men and lay women who are anagamis and stream winners, because of that, the holy life taught by the Buddha is complete and accomplished. And it's a very, very good thing to say that, because in the time of the Buddha there were many men and women, non-returners, there was many monks and nuns who were fully enlightened, and that's why it was an accomplished religion. If there was just a teacher and nobody else, it would be worthless. Not worthless, but not very complete. In the same way, even today, if there were no arahats, no male or female arahats, no non-returners, no lay men and lay women, stream winners, you could very well say the Buddhism is incomplete. And the Buddha carries on. Just as the river Ganges inclines towards the sea, slopes towards the sea, flows towards the sea and merges with the sea, says Vajra Gotama, so too Master Gotama's assembly with its homeless ones and its householders inclines towards Nibbana, slopes towards Nibbana, flows towards Nibbana, and eventually merges with Nibbana. So hopefully that you all qualify as Master Gotama's assembly, that you are sloping towards Nibbana, inclining towards Nibbana, flowing towards Nibbana, like the river Ganges, eventually to merge with Nibbana. And Vajra Gotama replies, Magnificent Master Gotama, Magnificent Master Gotama, Master Gotama has made the Dhamma clear in many ways, as though he were turning upright what had been overthrown, revealing what was hidden, showing the way to one who was lost, holding up a lamp in the dark for those with eyesight to see forms. I go to Master Gotama for refuge, and to the Dharma, and to the Sangha of Bhikkhus. I would receive the going forth under Master Gotama. I would receive the full admission as a monk. He asked to become a bhikkhu under the Buddha. The Buddha replies, Watcha, one who formerly belonged to another sect, and desires the going forth and the full admission in this Dharma and discipline, this Dharma and Vinaya, lives on probation for 4 months. Only the end of 4 months, if the monks are satisfied, not me, but the monks are satisfied with him, they give him the going forth and the full admission to the bhikkhu state. But I recognize individual differences in this matter. But Vajra Gotama replies, Venerable Sir, if those who formerly belong to another sect, desiring the going forth and the ordination as a bhikkhu, have to live on probation for 4 months, and if at the end of the 4 months, only if the monks are satisfied can they go forth and gain the full admission as a bhikkhu, then I will live on probation for 4 years. Only after the end of the 4 years, if the monks are satisfied with me, let them give me the going forth and the full ordination. And of course, with that degree of giving up, the Buddha ordained him straight away. Then the wanderer Vajra Gotama received the going forth under the Blessed One himself, and he received the full admission. And not long after his full admission, a half month after his full admission, only 2 weeks, the Venerable Vajra Gotama went to the Blessed One again, and after paying homage to him, he sat down on one side and told the Blessed One. He noticed the difference, and now he placed homage and sat down on one side. At the beginning, not being a full disciple, he just exchanged courteous talk. And he asked, Venerable Sir, I have attained whatever can be attained by the knowledge of a disciple in higher training. by the true knowledge of a disciple in higher training after only 2 weeks. Let the Blessed One teach the Dhamma further. In that case, Vacca developed further 2 things, samatha and vipassana, serenity and insight. When these 2 things are developed further, they will lead to the penetration of many elements. And please notice, not just vipassana, not just samatha, develop these 2 together. These 2 in the sutras are always developed together. There's never anything as pure samatha, nor as pure vipassana. The Buddha said, develop these 2 things, not just 1 thing, vipassana and samatha. And then, to the extent that you wish, you will be able to wield the various types of supernormal power. To the extent that you wish, you will be able to hear the divine sounds. To the extent, whatever you wish, you will understand the minds of other beings. To the extent that you wish, you may be able to recollect your past lives. To the extent that you wish, you may be able to see the workings of karma. And to the extent that you wish, you will realize the destruction of the outflowings, understanding the Four Noble Truths, and become enlightened one yourself. Then the Venerable Vacca Gotā, having delighted and rejoiced in the Blessed One's word, rose from his seat, and after paying homage to the Blessed One, keeping him on his right side, he departed. You can understand it's the way we circumambulate the stupas. In that time they would circumambulate the Buddha where he was sitting. By keeping him on his right side, you go around in a clockwise direction. It's called Padakina. Now you can see there that teaching which the Buddha gave him 2 weeks afterwards was teaching him to develop samatha and vipassana to get the what's called the 6 knowledges, the supernormal powers, being able to have the divine eye, the divine ear, lead people's minds, to see the past lives, to understand karma, and eventually to become enlightened. Now, before long, dwelling alone, withdrawn, diligent, ardent, and resolute, and those are all very necessary, dwelling alone, withdrawn from the world, diligent, ardent, and resolute, the Venerable Vacca Gotā, by realizing for himself with direct knowledge, here and now, entered upon and abided in that supreme goal of the holy life, for the sake of which clansmen rightly go forth from the home life into homelessness. He directly knew birth is destroyed. The holy life has been lived. What had to be done has been done. There is no more coming to any state of being. And the Venerable Vacca Gotā became one more of the arahats. Now on that occasion a number of monks were going to see the Blessed One. The Venerable Vacca Gotā saw them coming in the distance. Seeing them, he went to them and asked them, "Where are the Venerable Ones going?" "We are going to see the Blessed One, friend." "In that case, may the Venerable Ones pay homage in my name with their heads at the Blessed One's feet." And here we see how we should pay homage to our teachers. Saying, "Venerable Sirs," telling the Buddha, the monk Vacca Gotā pays homage with his head at the Blessed One's feet, then saying, "The Blessed One has been worshipped by me, the Sublime One has been worshipped by me." What does he mean by that? That is the way they said that he has attained enlightenment. That's the only way you can fully worship your teacher, by fulfilling the instructions. "Yes, friends," those monks replied. Then they went to the Blessed One, and after paying homage to him, they sat down at one side and told the Blessed One, "Venerable Sir, the Venerable Vacca Gotā pays homage with his head at the Blessed One's feet and says, the Blessed One has been worshipped by me, the Sublime One has been worshipped by me." And the Buddha replied, "Monks, having encompassed his mind with my own mind, I already knew of the Bhikkhu Vacca Gotā. The Bhikkhu Vacca Gotā has attained the threefold knowledge and has great supernormal power and might. And deities, devas, also told me this. The monk Vacca Gotā has attained the threefold knowledge and has great supernormal power and might, was an arahat." So this is actually how in the time of the Buddha monks would have said that they had attained enlightenment. They wouldn't go around saying, "I'm an arahat, I'm fully enlightened." They just would tell the Buddha, "We have worshipped you." What is he saying here? "Venerable Sir, the Venerable Vacca Gotā pays homage with his head. The Blessed One has been worshipped by me. The Sublime One has been worshipped by me." That's how we worship our teachers.
That is what the Blessed One said, those monks were satisfied and delighted in the Blessed One's words. That is an abbreviation of the Mahavacca Gotha Sutta number 73 of the Digha Nikaya, repeated here just about 300 metres away in the bamboo grove over 2,500 years ago. The tale of a person who became fully enlightened, first of all by just understanding what was wholesome, what was good and what wasn't good, and getting enough faith in the Buddha's answer to actually to ask further, are there any more people in your teaching who are arahats? And if you would say no, that you know you can teach this path, it's true, but it doesn't work, what would be the point of all this practice? So I know that when I was in Sri Lanka recently, that people asked, is it still possible to become a stream winner, or once return and non-return arahat in this time? And you said with certainty, yes, of course it is. And that gave them a lot of faith, because that makes the path open to people even in these days. It makes Buddhism complete. If there was no opportunity to become enlightened, the teaching would be incomplete. And the Buddha actually says here, just how many people in that time were enlightened? Heaps and heaps and heaps of people, both men and women, monks and nuns. And that was enough for actually Vajragotha to have faith. Yeah, if it's possible for others, it's possible for me. So he went forth, and the main teaching he was given was just the simple samatha and vipassana, calm and insight. As his vehicle, and in no long time, Vajragotha became another arahant. And that's how he showed he was an arahant, by just getting the other monks to say, the Blessed One has been worshipped by me. The Sublime One has been worshipped by me. So Mahavacca Sutta. Is there any comments about that? Any questions anyone has about the sutta? Could you hear it okay? Any questions you have about that sutta? Okay, I'm going to read out another extract from another sutta, which also happened here at Vajragotha. Hey, you got a question? Someone? Okay. Another sutta, which is not very often read out, it's an obscure sutta, but I love this sutta because it talks about forest monks. And it's part of this sutta which is very interesting, and which also reflects a little question and answer session we had at the Satipani cave this afternoon. This is a Gaudiswami sutta. Thus have I heard on one occasion the Blessed One was living at Vajragotha in the bamboo grove, a short distance from here again, at a squirrel's sanctuary. Now on that occasion a monk named Gaudiswami, a forest dweller, a forest monk, of lax behaviour, had come on a visit to stay in the midst of the Sangha, in the bamboo grove for some reason or another. Then the Venerable Sariputta addressed the monk with reference to the bhikkhu Gaudiswami thus. Even in those times, bamboo grove, as I mentioned to people, would be the central little monastery around here where the Buddha would stay for a while, give his many teachings. But the monks, especially the forest monks, they would actually live out on the hillsides in the cave. When they say a forest monk, the literal meaning of forest should really be the wilderness monks. You didn't have to live under a tree or in a forest to become a forest monk. It used to be at least, according to the definition by the commentaries, more than 1 kilometre from the nearest town or village. Obviously, it usually meant much more than that. And you can see the Vulture's Peak tomorrow is very much like a forest abode, a place a long way away, a place of solitude. So this is where forest monks would usually live, a long way away from anybody else. But unfortunately, some forest monks are lax. And the reason is, by living by yourself, without any schedule, without any bells, it's very easy to sleep in the morning, to go to bed early, and do nothing but just lay around and sleep all day. That's a danger for forest-dwelling monks. But the Sariputta addressed the monks. When a forest-dwelling monk comes to the Sangha and is living in the Sangha, he should be respectful and deferential towards his companions in the holy life. If he is disrespectful and undeferential, His fellows in the holy life will say, what has a venerable forest dweller gained by his dwelling alone in the forest, doing as he likes, since he is disrespectful and undeferential towards the companions in the holy life? When a forest dwelling monk comes to the Sangha and is living in the Sangha, he should be skilled in good behaviour, especially regarding where he should sit. If he is not, they say, what's the good of him dwelling alone? The monk comes to the Sangha and living in the Sangha from the forest, he should not enter the village too early or return too late in the day. If he enters the village too early or returns late in the day, they will say, what has he learned by living in the forest? He should not go before the meal or after the meal to visit families, in other words, not to associate too much with the families. Otherwise, they say, what's the use of that forest dweller living in the forest doing what he likes? He hasn't learned anything. He should not be haughty or vain. He should not be rough-tongued and loose-spoken. He should be easy to correct. He should associate with good friends. These are all regarding his conduct. Because forest monks, living alone, doing as they like, if they don't train themselves, then they say, what's the point of living alone? You're not actually growing in the Dharma, certainly not in your conduct. A forest dwelling monk should guard the door of his senses. If he doesn't guard the door of his senses, they will say, what's the use of him dwelling in the forest? What has he gained if he can't do even that much? He should be moderate in eating. Otherwise, they say, what has he gained by living in the forest, doing as he like? Should be devoted to wakefulness, in other words, not sleeping around and being lazy. He should be energetic, not sort of slothful. He should be established in mindfulness. If he's unmindful, there'll be those who would say of him, what has this venerable forest dweller gained by his dwelling alone in the forest, doing as he likes, since he is unmindful? A forest dwelling monk should be concentrated. If he's not concentrated, they will say of him, what is this venerable forest dweller gain by dwelling alone in the forest, doing as he likes, since he is unconcentrated? A forest dwelling monk should be wise. If he is not wise, they will say of him, what is this venerable forest dweller gain by his dwelling alone in the forest, doing as he likes, since he is not wise? A forest dwelling monk should apply himself to the Abhidharma and the Abhivinaya. And this is the point which I really like. Now, what's the forest monk doing studying the Abhidharma and the Abhivinaya? Because it says, if he does not do this, they say there are people who actually would ask questions of forest dwelling monks, since they would think that he should be an expert in these matters. And if he cannot answer the questions about the Abhidharma and the Abhivinaya, they would say, what would be the purpose of him living alone in the forest? Now I mention that because so far you understand living alone in the forest, doing what he's liking, not having much training there, and coming especially after being established in mindfulness, being established in concentration, it makes it very clear that the Abhidharma and the Abhivinaya were not a selection of books which people studied, because the forest monks went into study. They were practitioners, guarding the senses, being very good in their speech, in their actions, not being vain, not being proud, establishing mindfulness, concentration. The Abhidharma and the Abhivinaya literally means the deeper Dharma, the deeper Vinaya, not in words, but in the meaning of the Vinaya, the heart of the Vinaya, the heart of the Dharma. In the same way that you would expect forest monks to be able to answer all the questions on jhana and the deep dhammas, not because they've read the books, but because they've reached those states and they understand them through experience, that's what we mean by the Abhidharma and the Abhivinaya in the Gurisana Sutta. It's not just the theory, but the experience. Understanding what the Vinaya really means. What the Vinaya is, the rules for the monks. The underlying principles of the Vinaya, the underlying principles of the Dhamma. And it carries on. And a forest dwelling monk should apply himself to those liberations that are peaceful and immaterial, which is that those four states which come after the jhanas. For those who would ask a forest dwelling monk questions on the liberations that are peaceful and immaterial,
If he does not explain those liberations, there will be those who would say of him, what has this venerable forest dweller gained by dwelling alone in the forest, doing as he likes? Since he does not apply himself to those liberations without peaceful and immaterial, transcending forms. In the same way that a person, if he doesn't know the Abhidhamma and the Abhivinaya, they would say that if he does not explain those Abhidhamma and Abhivinaya, they'd say, what has he gained by not applying himself? He didn't say learning, by applying himself to the Abhidhamma and Abhivinaya. And lastly, a forest dwelling monk should apply himself to superhuman states. The Uttari Manusa Dhamma are both the jhanas and also the states of enlightenment, extreme meaning once returning, non returning arahat. For those who would ask a forest dwelling monk questions on, say, the four states of enlightenment, and if they cannot answer those questions, there would be those who would say of them, what is a venerable forest dweller gained by his dwelling alone in the forest, doing as he likes? Since he does, so he does not know the reason why he went forth. That's the translation there. Since there would be those who would say of him, a forest dwelling monk should apply himself to supernormal states of enlightenment. Otherwise, he doesn't understand the reason why he went forth. When it was said to Venerable Mahamoggallana, ask the Venerable Sariputta, friend Sariputta, should these things be undertaken and practiced only by a forest dwelling monk or by a town dwelling monk as well? Friend Moggallana, these things should be undertaken and practiced not only by a forest dwelling monk, by a town dwelling monk as well. Or how much more so by a town dwelling monk? So I mention that because I am a forest monk. It's our tradition, it's a forest tradition. And this is what is expected of forest monks, to be experts in the Abhidhamma and the Abhivinaya. Otherwise, you say, what's the purpose of living in a forest? And what one of our teachers, our Bishop Ajahn Mahabhu, would always say, the Abhidhamma is in here, never in a book. Because people ask me today, after talking about the recitation of the Satipana cave, I mentioned that there's no mention there in the recitation of reciting the Abhidhamma. That was almost certainly what came afterwards. And these are two sutras which were taught just a stone's throw away from here in the Bamboo Grove Monastery 2,500 and something years ago. Any questions on that? Yeah.
In France, the sutra refer to forest monk having a supernormal state of enlightenment. Is that a different state of enlightenment?
Oh, no. This, these right. Are called superhuman states. It's a technical term in Buddhism called, it's called Uttari, which means above. Manusa means human beings. Dhamma means like above all the human states. And that is used in particular for the jhanas, but also for the four stages of enlightenment, stream meaning watch returning, non-returning arahat. Because it's already mentioned the deep states of meditation, this is obviously meaning here the four stages of enlightenment. Because they say the forest dwelling monk should apply himself or herself to the four stages of enlightenment. Because people would ask him questions about that, and they would expect the forest dwelling monks to know answers to those questions. It was as if the forest dwelling monks should have a deeper experience than the town dwelling monks, simply because they had the opportunity to practice much more than those in the cities who were doing a lot of service to the lay community. So these are the responsibilities of forest dwelling monks. And I tell you that because this is a forest dwelling tradition. So, my monks, you should be able to ask some questions on the Abhidhamma and the Abhivinaya. And if they can't answer those questions, they're not experienced with actually these superior human states, streaming, watch returning, non returning, arahat, you could actually say to them, have you forgotten the reason why you went forth? No, this is, if you are an anagami, non-returner, yes, celibacy.
It's not a requirement in the sense that you have to do this first to be able to become an anagami. It's just what happens when you become an anagami. So an anagami, a non-returner, is someone who's overcome all sensual lust. So there's no possibility of having sexual intercourse if you are an anagami or an arahat. It simply just cannot be achieved. It's not to say that it's against the rules, it's just like against the natural laws of nature for someone who is at that state. In the same way, you cannot get angry at anybody. So even a non-returner will never have any ill will or anger. It's not as if they try and suppress any ill will or they think that's against the rules. It becomes an expression of their nature. They cannot do those things anymore. So because of that, anyone who becomes a non-returner, male or female, monk or nun, whatever it is, the sensuality and their ill will get destroyed once and for all and never can arise again. Which is one way you can understand and tell who is a non-returner or enlightened and who is not. If a person has lust, they cannot be in the lust state, nor if they can have, they have ill will and they get angry at you. It's a good way of telling. So because of that, that if any of the lay people, the men and women, became a non-returner, they'd automatically be celibate. Not a requirement, but a description of the state. Any other questions while we are here? Please ask me questions, because I know there's people who aren't even Buddhist on this trip. There's some people who are just becoming Buddhist, some people who are just young Buddhists, some people who have been Buddhist for a long time. But nevertheless, I'm always going to try and make these questions very deep, make these talks quite deep and profound, simply out of respect for the places we're visiting. The reason that people were enlightened at the time of the Buddha and at different stages of enlightenment. So it's interesting from that sutta you saw just how a person expressed their enlightenment. Because they wouldn't actually say, I am enlightened or I am a non-returner. Because that goes against the fundamental attainment of those states, which is based on non-self. If one has a sense of self, everyone will say that I am this, I am that, as if it was some sort of, oh, some promotion on some sort of scale of, what's it called, some elite scale of beings. But this is an abandonment of the self, an abandonment of the ego, abandonment of pride and judging. So the way that the monk expressed the Buddha that he was an arahat, he didn't say, I'll just go and tell the Buddha I'm an arahat. If he'd have said that, the Buddha said, no way if you say things like that. He said that, you know, the Buddha has been worshipped. The task has been done. And you see that even the way that the Buddha described these things, birth has been destroyed. There is no more coming to any state of being. The task has been completed. There's never any sort of saying, I am enlightened. It's a different way of talking, which is actually without any sense of personality or self. So it's an interesting, just in those ways that monks would just, nuns, lay people describe their attainments. They would just say what's destroyed, what's gone, what's left behind. The enlightenment wouldn't really be an attainment, not something they've got. It would just be measured by how much they've abandoned. So as my teacher Ajahn Chah would always say in meditation, you don't meditate to get more things. You don't meditate to attain something. You meditate to let go, to abandon, to renounce things. So the same way of these attainments. They're stages of renunciation, not stages of accomplishments. Go on.
The joke. Now you were talking once about you're in Ajahn Chah's sitting with Ajahn Chah and a lot of other monks, and Ajahn Chah actually says, and he was enlightened, and I remember you
Yes, so yeah, it's one of the months.
One of the months, whatever.
Yeah, he didn't actually say if they're enlightened. His question was, has anyone destroyed the three defilements? Has anyone has abandoned the kilesas? So he never said he was enlightened. The monk put the hand up and said, yes, the three kilesas have been abandoned in me. Different way of saying things. And it's not just being clever, this different way of saying, there's a reason why it's a different way of saying things. It's a saying about enlightenment which doesn't make it an attainment in the normal sense of the word in English, not something which you gain, not some accolade, not some medal which you attain, or some stripes or pitch you have on your soldier because you've been promoted in the army. It's an abandonment of things. Which is also shows the power. See how much you can get power.
Yeah, but you oftentimes describe that saying of Buddha that enlightenment exists but no one on the path.
Also, yes. That's a very beautiful saying. That's in the Buddha Gosa reported that in the Suttimagga, saying like enlightenment is. So let's say the path is, but no traveller on it to see. Enlightenment is, but not the one who enters it.
Does that kind of mean that pretty well anyone who is enlightened is pretty circumspect about it?
It just disappears.
In the this person's enlightened, this person's heaps of people became enlightened, but then, you know, what you're saying is that when you get down to the crunch of it, that people are very circumspect about actually playing.
Yeah.
And so,
it's not circumspect.
You actually have this sort of discussion about whether a person is, shall we say, across the line, or there is no person. What you're saying is there is no person there.
That's right, yeah. There's one of these monks many years ago. Some of you in Singapore remember him, a fellow called Ananda Mangala. He's a very wonderful monk, and he gave some great talks. Very funny, but also some very profound. And he said that when somebody asked him if he was enlightened, he said, no, I'm not enlightened, I'm highly illuminated. It's a very beautiful way. Not illuminated, highly illuminated. There's a very wonderful way of actually sort of explaining what enlightenment is, being highly illuminated. So see how much you can illuminate yourself, Chris. And the more illuminated you are, the more illuminated you are. Okay, so any other comments or questions before we call it a night? Okay, let's call it a night now, because tomorrow morning we have to get up quite early. Is book around or is she resting? Oh, there you are. You're right. So 3 o'clock is when we get up. What time does the bus leave? I think 3 o'clock is enough time to get up in the morning, but we leave at 3:30. But when you get up, I think that should be plenty of time. I think 3:30. We get there at 4 o'clock. Yeah. The bus will leave at 3:30. So tomorrow morning, 3 o'clock, the bus will leave at 3:30, and tomorrow morning, I'm going to make this rule that you're here 3:30, the bus leaves. So if you're not on the bus at 3:30, we don't take you. We're not going to be counting people. We're not going to sort of see who's here and who's not here. Because sometimes we wait for some stragglers. Sometimes everybody misses out on the beautiful experience up at the Vulture's Peak. So, will you get a wake-up call at 3 o'clock? Okay, everyone will get the wake. Sorry? Yes, so you will all get a wake-up call at 3 o'clock. Many of you have alarm clocks, you can set it at 3 o'clock. So you get up, go to the toilet, and get out to the bus, because the breakfast will come much later. So you don't need to sort of go and have a shower or anything. Don't even need to make your bed. 3 o'clock, get up, simply do that another day, and whiz off to the bus. Because at 3:30, it goes. And no, if you're not late to the bus, we're not going to stop for you.
is the chance of a lifetime to be able to go up and see the sunrise on the Vulture's Peak. To be up there, just to meditate. Those people who think it's very difficult to walk up, there's a very easy walk up there. Those people are really having trouble. We've got the dollies arranged tomorrow morning, and I guarantee they're absolutely safe. Those people going up in the palanquins, those guys who actually take you up, they're so strong and they're so nimble on their feet. You go up really fast, and it's very, very safe. And you'll also be able to enjoy sort of the sunrise and meditating on top of the Vulture's Peak, which I must say personally that that's the one place on this tour which I love the best. It's a great place to actually to be in the morning meditating as the sun rises. But don't worry about sleep. You've slept so much in your life. Now this is one time, a chance of a lifetime, to go to one of the most powerful places on the planet. So 3 o'clock, wake up. Quick to go to the toilet and then come out to dinner.
Yes.
In the afternoon, Nalanda, you can have a rest afterwards in the morning when you come back. We have breakfast when we come back about 7:30, so you have plenty to eat later on. Have a breakfast later on, and then you can, those of you who want a breakfast after you're enlightened, maybe when you get up there and you're enlightened, you think, oh, who wants a breakfast anymore? And for those of you who want to have your head shaved in the afternoon, we'll do that before going to Nalanda. We've got 4 monks here, not quite enough for the day, but we can find another monk from somewhere to give you the going for. So see what happens tomorrow. Okay, so it's only 8:30, so you'll be back in your room, plenty of time by 9 o'clock. 9 o'clock you'll probably be all fast asleep and ready at about 3 o'clock in the morning when the wake up call comes. Ah, we used to get up every morning at 3 o'clock in Thailand. Sometimes used to get up earlier than that. I remember this one monastery that the little novices missed the morning meeting at 3 o'clock, and the abbot said, if you novices aren't here tomorrow, the bell goes at 2 o'clock. And those monasteries weren't there, so the next week the bell went at 2 o'clock. So if any of you aren't here the following morning, we get up at 2 o'clock. No, we don't do that here. So please, 3 o'clock, it's a nice time to get up in the morning. We go up, have the beautiful experience of the sunrise and the Vulture's Peak, and then afterwards you can have breakfast, you can sleep as much as you like later on. Okay, so we can now bow our face to the Buddha Dhamma Sangha. If you all have a nice rest, I'll see you in the morning at 3.
Arahaṃ sammā sambuddho bhagavā buddhaṃ bhagavantaṃ abhivādhe savākātho bhagavata dhammo sammānamassāṃ Supadipano bhagavato sāvaka-saṅgho saṅghaṃ